Yona Knight Wisdom is a man making Jamaican sporting history. 24-year-old was the first Jamaican to take part in an Olympic diving competition in 2016, fulfilling a dream he had when he was just 9 years old. He was the first Jamaican to medal in a world diving competition in 2016 and has gone from strength to strength. But things could have been very different for the Leeds-born athlete. As he says in his own words, he's a heavy diver and he's black. And that's not something you see very often in diving competition. In this episode, Yona takes us through the reasons why you don't see that very often, from stereotypes to culture. He also tells us about just how different life would be if he wasn't competing for Jamaica. And with the 2020 Olympics coming up, he takes us through his journey to Tokyo. But there's also plenty of podcast conversation with Yona, who also acts as host of the Athlete's Voice podcast. This time, he is turning from interviewer to interviewee as he continues to make history in his sport. Yona, it's a warm welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for taking some time out to sit down with us and have a chat all about you, your life and your sport. How is everything at the moment, considering you've just got off a train from Scotland to be here?
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to come on the podcast. I'm all right. I'm missing a day of training to come down to London for the day. I'm going to a Jamaican-inspired event tonight. And, you know, as I said, I've just got off a train, 4-hour journey down from Edinburgh, so it's been a bit of a trek, but I feel good, excited for a good day in London, and excited for a good conversation on the podcast.
Exactly. Hope it's totally worth 4 hours on the train. but we've got, like say on the podcast, we've got plenty to get through and plenty to talk about, not least some of the history-making results, really, that you've achieved in the last few years. But I'll start with a quote from yourself, and it's probably a quote you've had repeated back to you quite a few times, and it's this: I am 1.90 meters tall, I weigh 90 kilograms, I'm a heavy diver, I'm black. If you watch diving competitions, it's not something you'll see very often. Why don't we see that very often?
It's just so uncommon. It's everything about it is against the sport of diving. So if you've watched diving, you see a lot of short people that are very strong. That means they can swim very fast in the air whilst jumping pretty high, can do some very difficult dives and also make very little splash. From a stereotype point of view, the stereotype is black people can't swim. So to see a black person in a swimming event, never mind a diving event, is very, very uncommon. And you know, like as I say, being tall, being heavy, it just doesn't work for diving. So, to be fair, when you were saying which quote you're going to go with, I was wondering which one, because I've said a few things over the years, and I was wondering which one it was going to be. But in that one, I was just trying to sum up how unusual it is for me to be in the position that I'm in today, in the diving world, actually being competitive at world competitions, because it is so unusual to see not only someone that is of an Afro-Caribbean race, but of my size and stature competing to a world level in a diving event, because as I say, there's not many of us whatsoever.
I suppose you almost consider it like the gymnastics maybe of swimming, if that's fair to say, because I suppose people expect you to be short and nimble and things like that, but well, clearly that's not the case.
That's the combinations, gymnastics and swimming, and that was my background as well. Like I started off swimming when I was very, very young. My parents took me swimming, and then I also managed to find my way into gymnastics when I was quite young as well. And it was due to my gymnastics foundation that I was good at diving when I started, and that helped me progress very, very quickly. Especially in gymnastics, like you don't see tall people that frequently in gymnastics. So it relates very well to diving. A lot of divers come from gymnastics, so they're usually quite short. It's very, very rare, very rare.
In terms of the stereotype that you mentioned, you don't often see people of an Afro-Caribbean race, for example, doing a swimming event. Does that play on the minds of say, young people from a similar background to you that maybe subconsciously think to themselves, I can't go into a swimming event because of what other people say or think?
I think it'll be a little bit the case of that. I think it's more a cultural thing. So culturally, if you're black growing up, on an American point of view, you play basketball, you play American football, you sprint. In Jamaica, you sprint, or football, less so. In England, you probably play football, you play rugby. You don't often go into aquatic sports. Just culturally, it's not a thing. You don't have as many role models to look up to. You don't have that natural person that will inspire you to get into that kind of sport, just because of the culture and because of the what people around you do. You know, as I say, when I started diving when I was younger, there was no one from my area where I grew up that did diving. It just wasn't a thing. So it was very unusual for me, you know, with my friends that I grew up with around me, it was very unusual for me to be doing diving, especially when they were doing, you know, they were going out or, you know, playing at the park or whatever, playing football, things like that. I'd say, oh no, actually I can't play because I've got training. It's an unusual thing, and not many people would like actually commit to it, because they'd want to hang out with their friends or whatever. But I found so much enjoyment in diving, that it was just natural for me, even though it wasn't culturally the normal thing for me to do.
Is it the enjoyment almost outweighing what culture is essentially telling you to do?
Yeah, 100%. And I was also good at it, which helped.
That helped.
I was good at it. I enjoyed it and I was good at it. And when you get that combination, then you've got a recipe for success, 100%.
Was there ever any pressure on you to maybe turn to football or something like that, and or maybe that will to fit in with everyone else?
I'd never say any pressure, no. Like, definitely not from my parents. My parents were keen to just let me do whatever I was happy to do. You know, they wanted to give me the best chance for success. They wanted to guide me in the right direction, as a person, not even as an athlete. So when I found diving, they wanted to support that as much as they could, especially since I enjoyed it so much. But no, there was never any pressure to do any kind of sport. I mean, I tried everything. Like, at school, I went to Leeds Grammar School, and that is a very strong school in terms of sport. So we had a very strong rugby team, strong football team, strong cricket team. We're good at athletics. So naturally, I joined in with all those sports and tried to do as well as possible, because a lot of my friends played those sports. But the one thing that I had was very good self-awareness, and I realised very, very quickly that I was awful at football, I was awful at rugby, I hated the cold, I wasn't very good at cricket, I wasn't that fast as a track and field athlete, couldn't play tennis, couldn't do anything else, and diving was the only one that I was actually good at, so naturally, I stuck at it.
Same story with me at football. I realised I was terrible, so I packed it in.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realise that. Early enough, people are like, oh no, I might get better, I'll still get better. No, if you're rubbish from the start, it's likely you're going to stay rubbish. There's only a few people that actually improve dramatically to become, you know, acceptable at a sport.
Exactly. And I'll turn the clock back then to a 9-year-old Yona.
Yeah.
And your parents took you to your local swimming club then, and that was around the time that the 2004 Athens Olympics were on as well. And you said around then that you could go to the Olympics, and you talked about the self-awareness.
Yeah.
Did you fully believe, even at that age? Because I don't think 9-year-old me would have had that amount of self-awareness about myself. But did you really believe at that age that you were that good, you could one day achieve that?
It's hard to say, because I don't think that I particularly believed that I would be there. And I didn't really actually think about it that much. I just remember watching the Olympics on TV. I saw Pete Waterfield and Leon Taylor win their silver medal in the men's semi-synchro. I saw that, I was like, that looks fun, that looks awesome, I'd love to be a part of that. And it just stuck in my mind, like, the whole ideals of the Olympics just stuck in my mind. And as I say, I didn't particularly believe it could be possible, even up until maybe 2012, when I'd started representing Jamaica. That was probably the only point where I was like, you know what, this is actually realistic. Before that, I just did it for the fun of it. I tried to get as good as possible. I was kicked back quite a few times with British diving, like not making it into the squads, and, you know, seeing my friends succeed ahead of me. You know, they were better than me at the time, I guess. But it served as motivation to try and keep on getting better. But, you know, back when I was 9, I just I just saw it and wanted to be a part of it.
The getting the kickbacks as well, because it's something quite a few people have talked about, because everyone suffered those kickbacks in one way or another, even if it's from a team event or maybe something more personal. But it's the reaction that I see so often in sports people is that they can turn that into a motivation, whereas maybe a lot of people struggle to do that.
Yeah.
Was it a struggle, or was it relatively easy to actually turn it back on itself and use it to fuel your passion, really?
It just felt natural. It just felt 100% natural. Like, I almost felt like I had no other choice. Like, this was what I was just doing, and I'll just try and do it to the best of my ability. Fortunately for me, opportunities came about which allowed me to push it even further. Like, if the whole Jamaica thing wasn't suggested in 2010, 2011, I don't think I'd still be diving now, because I think I would have really struggled to make it into the British squad. I don't think I would have improved as much as I did between the years of 2012 and 2016, because I wouldn't have had the opportunities that I got with Jamaica to improve and get the experience that I needed. You know, I had a lot of bad results in those years, especially the World Championships in 2015. I dived terribly, and that was the year before the Olympics. I was like, how am I going to make it to the Olympics when I'm diving this bad? Like, I was so far out. And that was the case, like, kind of through the entire journey. I remember, I think it was 2010, we had our, or maybe 2011 actually, we had a Junior Elite Nationals, and this was still when I was trying to represent Great Britain. And I actually dived quite well for one of the first times. I dived really well. I got a silver medal on 1 meter. I think I was fourth or third on 3 meter, and I was just outside the medals on tower as well. I think I was in contention to make it into the squad for the Junior Europeans. And I didn't get picked. And it was that made me realise that I had to take the Jamaican opportunity. I had to go with that. I heard later on that my coach actually recommended them to not select me because he believed so much in Jamaica working. That would have had a bad effect on me representing Jamaica, so I would have had to like wait a year or whatever. But yeah, there were so many times where I didn't make it into a team, or I was watching my friends, you know, abroad competing, and I was kind of sat there thinking, is this really for me? Like, am I really good enough for this? Can I really continue this realistically? Should I just pack it in now and try and do something else? But those thoughts never lasted too long. I was like, okay, I'll just go back to training and try and work harder. As simple as that.
In terms of the nationality and representing Jamaica, and so often I see, be it your Twitter army or your armchair viewer, just thinking someone has picked that country purely because they've got a better chance of representing or making it to a competition because there's not enough people in their way.
Yeah.
But actually hearing like what's happened to you, for example, because you did reach the Olympics and fulfill that goal, but it's so much more going down that Jamaica route than just picking a different country, because it's the support background that's there as well, which really makes... Well, sounds like it's made a real difference to how you've actually progressed as a diver.
Well, I can't lie, like, it was definitely the easier option representing Jamaica. There's no other Jamaican divers. I didn't have that competition to get to events, which made my life so much more straightforward. That made, as I say, the 2016 Olympics like a realistic opportunity. So it was easier in theory, but it was also kind of my only option, because I think that based on the other divers that were representing Great Britain, there was not really much of a chance of me making it into that team. As we've spoken before about my stature, about my height, it's so unlikely that I'd turn out to be a good diver. I think everyone that's watched me progress from 2012 onwards have been extremely surprised. Even my coaches are so surprised at where I am, because they didn't think it was possible. They had confidence in me, but they didn't think some of the dives that I'd be doing now, some of the results that I've achieved, they didn't think it was possible. So it was really my only option. But by no means was it straightforward, because I didn't have the same kind of support structure like British divers do in terms of UK sport. I didn't have that funding. I had to go out and find my own sponsor. I think it was my coach that initially suggested Levi Roots. And, you know, I sent him an email, didn't get a response. My dad was like, send another one. I was like, no, I don't want to. I'm scared of getting, you know, another rejection. But I eventually sent another one, got a positive reply, and then had a meeting. And, you know, he became my funding support basis for my like, competitions. But, you know, not every person would be able to kind of go out there and get it. Or I think I got very lucky in terms of timing. Not everyone would have that perfect timing either. So you know, it as kind of easy, it made it easier in certain ways, but it was still so difficult. It had such a long way to go. So by no means was it like just jumping onto a different bandwagon or a different ship. Absolutely no way.
And a lesson to everyone to always follow up on your emails.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously, I mean, you must think about where you might be now had you not gone down that route as well. Because, I mean, I list some of the achievements here. Obviously, the dream came true at the Olympics in 2016. But let's not forget the important results before that, because there was a 5th place on the 1 meter springboard and 11th in the 3 meter springboard at the Commonwealth Games in 2014 in Glasgow. February 2016, you finished 2nd in the 3 meter springboard during the FINA Diving World Cup. That was in Rio, and that was Jamaica's first medal in a world diving competition. So when it comes to the Olympics, there you are, 21 years old. You've achieved the dream, essentially, that 9-year-old Yona wanted to set out and achieve. Yeah. How do you actually handle all of that? Because not only the first Jamaican diver at the Olympics, but you're the first from a Caribbean island, representing Caribbean island, to be at the Olympics as well.
I don't think I'll gain a full appreciation of the history until I retire, and until I can like fully look back on it. I was just riding the wave. As you say, I got that silver medal at the World Cup. That was off the back of me riding the wave. The pressure was on that prelim. I went into the prelim, did the performance that I needed to do to get my spot, got the spot, and then after that, I was just riding the wave through to the Olympics, and everything that was in front of me, like, I wasn't fazed. I was just on cloud 9 like throughout the entire time. I was so happy. I was getting all these awards, and it just felt so natural. I didn't feel any kind of pressure. I was a little bit concerned about when I got to the Olympics, because it was such a big dream for me since 9 years old. You know, I wasn't sure how I was going to react, even just being in the village, seeing all the Olympic rings. I'm a massive sports fan, so walking around the village and seeing all the other athletes around, you know, like, I walked past Simone Biles, I was on the same coach as Alison Felix from the airport to the village. It was just mind-blowing, left, right and centre. But I dealt with it all so well, like, it didn't bother me until I got on the board for my first dive. I stood there, I looked around, I've just made a post about it, and I thought, oh my God, this is it. Please do not mess up now. This is what you've been dreaming of. This is it. This is the moment. That was the only time that it really hit me.
Of all the times for it to hit you,
I know,
well.
Probably the worst time.
And then it's just keep fingers crossed from there on. But I mean, you made it to the semi-finals, didn't you, in the Olympics?
Yeah.
I'm right in saying, which, considering you're 21 as well, still relatively young.
It is, actually, yeah. It is really quite young. In the 3 meter springboard, it's an event where experience counts for so much, and actually strength as well, which you can only build in years. So 21 was actually a relatively early age, and even then I still thought I thought I was a big man. Like, I felt I was a lot older than I was. I felt like I was a lot more mature than I was, but looking back on that now, like, you know, I'm 24 now. I was so young and so inexperienced then compared to how I am now. I'm definitely a much better diver now than I was then, even though I haven't quite hit my personal best. As an all-round diver, I think I'm a much better diver compared to then, and you know, it's amazing thinking about it, being only 21 and seeing how much room I still had to grow. You know, not many people can achieve their life goal by the age of 21. Some people achieve it a lot earlier, but not many people achieve it by the age of 21.
Exactly.
It's really insane. It really is.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for Sportspiel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on LinkedIn. I'm picking up on one tweet that I saw you put out there, and you talked about sort of the biggest lesson that you got off the back of the Olympics, alongside the picture of your Olympic rings tattoo as well. And that was how people care, but they still get on with their lives. What kind of lesson are we talking about off the back of that?
Well, this has been the kind of journey that I've been on for the last 3 years since the Olympic Games. And it's funny, I had a very strange conversation with my friend Jack Law, who won the Olympic gold medal in the 3 meter synchro and then got a silver medal in the individual event, so had the most extraordinary Olympics ever. And he told me that he always thought that once you win an Olympic gold medal, you get £1 million and life is easy. But even his life has been difficult since the Olympic Games. Like, it's not been straightforward whatsoever. And that put things into perspective for me. I've been trying to understand myself a lot, because I had expectations coming off the back of an Olympic Games which were not real. And what actually happened, it wasn't how I expected it to turn out after the Games. Like, I literally got back from Rio and I spent probably about a week doing absolutely nothing. I spent most of my day just in bed, playing on my phone. But I thought beforehand, I'd be seeing so many people and, everyone would be congratulating me, there'd be parties for me, and I just thought all these crazy things. But it didn't happen, and it took me a long time to understand that that's not how it worked. So kind of in the years since then, I've been on a journey of just trying to understand that no one really cares about what you do. There are so many people on this planet. What you do as a person, there's probably three people that care about it. Three or four people that care about it. It's probably your best friend and your parents. There's not that many more people, because they all have their own problems to deal with. Everyone has their own life to get on with, and they just go forward, and they'll give you one day of celebration and that's it.
Then it's back to normality.
It's back to normality for everyone. You can't allow yourself to bask in those moments for too long. Enjoy it, by all means, enjoy it as much as you can, but you can't just rest on those moments, because times change and life goes on quickly.
Like you said before, I suppose you've been riding that wave for so long, but then once the Olympics comes and goes, that's kind of the wave has ended then.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have to start all over again.
You literally have to start again, 100%. I thought that my performances in 2016 would mean that I would be kind of considered as a much better diver to the judges, and that even if I made a little mistake in one of my dives, that the judges wouldn't score me as harshly, because I'm an Olympian and I'm a world silver medalist. But that was so unrealistic. I can't even believe that I thought those things now, but that's not how it works.
So then how important is it to you now to always have something other than diving to focus on? Maybe just or to have something to always to aim for when normality does come back again?
Well, I've always naturally had that, because I've always had education alongside training. So obviously I was always at school whilst I was training when I was younger.
And then university after that.
Went to university. And there's not many divers in Great Britain that do university and full-time diving, because they can't manage it. But it is possible to manage. You just have to be very disciplined. Also, it's a bit to do with your personality as well, because I'm naturally a person that enjoys being busy. And I feel like I get into a better flow when I have a lot of things going on, because I just do one thing and get it done as well as I can do. Then I move on to the next thing, get it done as well as I can do. Then I move on to the next thing, and I don't spend time dwelling on what I could have done better. But you just naturally learn how to improve. So once I finished uni in 2016, it almost felt like I fell off the edge of a cliff, because I had all this stuff going on, building up to the Olympics. Doing my dissertation, finishing uni, getting ready for the graduation, finding out my results, to getting back from Rio and being done with uni, and then I just had nothing apart from diving when I eventually got back to it. And then I just concentrated on diving for a long time, and I just didn't feel, I can't describe what it was, but something just didn't feel right. I felt like I was missing something, and that was what education gave to me, was something alongside diving to focus on.
It's kind of that emptiness, that kind of vacuum, I suppose, once everything's been done, then you've got to look for the next thing.
Yeah, 100%. I felt like I spent my time away from training just worrying about what I was going to do the next day at diving, or thinking about what I could have done better at training. And for me, that wasn't healthy. For other people, it works. That's fine. You just got to be aware of what it is that works for you, 100%. But for me, that absolutely didn't work. So I tried to find something. Once I realized that didn't work for me, I tried to find something. So found YouTube, tried to play around with that a little bit, which was fun for a while. I enjoyed it a lot, but for me didn't 100% work at the time as well. I don't think the timing was right. I'd love to go back into it at some point 100%, but the timing needs to be right. And then eventually I found podcasting, which I've been playing around with a little bit as well. And also alongside that, I do some coaching, which I've been doing since 2013. And those are the things that are keeping me, I guess, switched on, is the, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, that, I mean, that makes total sense, because it is on. Essentially keeping that brain active the entire time. And I mean, it seems to be working as well, because 2 years later at the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games in 2018, it was a fourth in the 1 meter springboard, mm-hmm. and then ninth in the 3 meter springboard. But I suppose when it comes to looking ahead, because I mean, we're what, less than a year away now from the next Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, do you set yourself results targets or anything like that, or is it just be the best, do the best you can at that specific moment in time?
I never set myself results-based targets. I feel that puts unnecessary pressure on myself, because all you can do is go out there and give your best. And if your best is good enough for a silver medal, fantastic. If your best is good enough for fourth or fifth, then, you know, work harder next time to get that medal. So it's funny you mentioned that result at Gold Coast, because that was actually... That was a defining moment for me, I think, in my career. One of three, I think. The other two was Shanghai in 2014, when I finished 31st on 3 meter, and that was the first time I cried after a diving event, because it made me realise how much I actually wanted it, and I was disappointed with how I did. Second one was Kazan in 2015 at the World Championships. I finished 37th. I realised that the lifestyle that I was living wasn't working for diving, so I had to change everything. So I just completely flipped it. I stopped drinking, stopped going out as much, just focused on diving, focused on what I needed to do, deleted my Netflix account, so I wasn't distracted away from training, so I could just focus on what I needed to focus on. And then I got success off the back of that. And then I think Gold Coast was another kind of defining moment for me, because that was when I realized that YouTube wasn't working for me. I was not doing YouTube for the right reasons. I was doing it to try and get views and try and get the little bit of advertising money that you can get. That's all I was trying to do it for, and that's not the right reasons to do it. So that fourth place actually really, really hurt me, and I was so close to a bronze. That was the first time I went into a competition, not expecting but believing that I could get a medal. That was the first time that's ever happened for me. And I missed out by one place and about 10 points, and that really, really hurt me. So I kind of... wrote off the entire year after that and just went through the motions, and then just decided that the next season I was going to switch back on. And it's, you know, showed its benefits, and I'm almost glad it happened in hindsight, because if I had got that bronze medal on 1 meter, I think it would have masked a lot of problems that was, you know, not helping me whatsoever. And a lot of things I needed to change, which I did eventually change.
And I suppose a little mini wake-up call, if you like, on certain aspects of your life.
100%.
And obviously, there was back in August, so just over a month ago now, there was the silver at the Pan Am Games as well, which must have been another great opportunity, and maybe another marker to yourself that things are going or progressing in the right way. And I suppose I'll then link the YouTube then back to the podcasting, because obviously anyone listening to this should be interested in the podcasting side of things.
Yeah.
And I mean, the podcast, for anyone who doesn't know, is called The Athlete's Voice, and includes weekly episodes from yourself, and you obviously had some guests on there as well, like Andre Wisdom, for example, the footballer. The motivations you had for YouTubing compared to the motivations you have for podcasting now, is that far healthier for you then? Because now it's primarily the love of talking to people and just the love of putting content out there.
Yeah, I think the main thing about it is trying to get out the positive energy that I feel I have within me. Like, I'm a very positive person. I genuinely think I have seasonal affective disorder, because when the weather changes, my mood changes. And it always used to be noticed when I went to training in winter and I was in a bad mood, for whatever reason that'd be. Like, the 3 days out of the year that I'd be in a bad mood, everyone would notice it, because I'm usually very talkative, very smiley, trying to get other people laughing. That's what I'm always like as a person in training every day. When I'm away from the pool, that's what I try to be like. And I wanted to try and get that out, because I think so many people can benefit from just having a positive outlook on life rather than looking at things negatively, which happens so naturally for a lot of people. And I think society almost pushes you into that kind of mindset, which I think is so wrong. And it's great to see that so many more people now are trying to put out positive energy in the same way that I am. So that's where like the YouTube thing originally came in. I just wanted to be positive and be fun and show that, you know, we can have a laugh as serious as we are in training. As I say, YouTube didn't quite work out for me at that time, but hopefully I'll come back to it at some point. But the podcasting, that's been the best way I can get the positive energy out. It's completely separate to my diving. Like, I'm not worrying about where my camera is set up at the pool, what's being recorded, you know, who could potentially mess up or mess with the camera. I do all the podcasting stuff away from the pool, away from training, and it's almost like a hobby that is completely unconnected, which YouTubing wasn't quite. So I feel like that's the best way to get the positive energy out. And also, I get to hear other people's stories, which I love doing as well. I love talking to people. I love hearing where they've come from and how they've got to the top of their sport or got to wherever they've got to in their sport, because I can relate to it so much. And so many of the stories that I have in my own head, which so many of them I haven't even shared with anyone yet, I can relate to every single little story because I've had every single element of highs and lows and ups and downs and everything. So that's for me what the podcast is. And you know, I enjoy doing it. I just want to take it forward, and as I say, it provides that little distraction away from training, which works out very perfectly for me,
and something we, myself and Will, can definitely relate to as well. Yeah. Considering we've been doing this for about 2 years now,
this is actually my first feature on someone else's podcast, which is really nice.
We'll take that as a crown. So I mean, but like you say, it's that connecting with someone, because I mean, talking about myself and Will, and we think about the people that we have talked to on this podcast that we would never have spoken to in a million years if we hadn't been doing this podcast, because we'd just be, you know, busy focusing on our jobs elsewhere. And I suppose you kind of pick up things and you learn things from your different guests as well. Yeah. If that's something you've ever learnt a lesson from someone that you've spoken to on your own podcast.
Every single conversation, every single time, you know, I can't even remember all the times, but there's always something, at least one thing in each conversation I've had where I've thought, you know what, interesting outlook, maybe I should try and kind of look at things in that way, or maybe I should be doing something in a certain way, or somehow I can learn from whatever you've done or the mistakes that you've made that's led to your bad moment, that I can avoid myself. And I've kind of always tried to use other people's experiences to learn for myself and try to not make the same mistakes as other people make. So I think it's almost a negative thing in certain ways, but also a positive thing. Positive in that I don't have to go through the bad experiences myself because I learn from other people's mistakes. But negative in the way that because I don't go through the really bad experiences, I don't learn the lesson as quickly as some other people do. For example, when I spoke to Jack a couple of weeks ago, he told me about his whole London 2012 experience and how that just went horribly wrong for him. And he told me the whole process of what he did during the competition, all the things that he did wrong. And, you know, I mean, I knew it at the time. I heard it at the time and I learned from it at the time. He said he was on Twitter during his event because Twitter was blowing up at the time, and he gained a load of followers. And he was on Twitter, like, looking at what people were saying about him during his event. That's not really something you should do in a diving event because you need to stay focused. So as soon as he told me that story, I was like, okay, great. I need to switch my plane on airplane mode. And I've been doing that ever since, even to the point where I think I did a competition recently, right? I put my phone on airplane mode. I was like, why do I even do this? Like, I see other people on the phone. What's the point? And speaking to Jack just on the podcast made me remember why I actually did it in the first place. I learned from his mistake. And I haven't had the same problem in one of my events. Like, I've never had such a disastrous event like that to teach me the lesson to not go on my phone during an event. And he said that was one of the biggest lessons for him. So since then, he's kind of stopped doing social media even in the week building up to an event, just to completely avoid it, because he doesn't want to repeat that situation whatsoever. Yeah. So
learning from your mistakes.
Yeah, exactly, 100%. And learning from other people's mistakes is maybe even more important than learning from your own mistakes.
And that social media side is quite an interesting one, because it's a question we've asked quite a few times to various people or various guests we've had on this podcast who have either decided to completely shun social media if there's a big event coming up. We look back at some of the England hockey players that we've had on in the past, and they took like a team-wide stance to not go on social media.
Yep.
But then when we had Mary Earps of the England football team, and asked her about what they were going to do for social media during the World Cup in the summer, and it was very much a player-by-player basis. So it's interesting to see how it works for some and it works for doesn't works for others in a different way. And I suppose is then social media for yourself good when it's not a high pressure situation, and maybe it just puts unnecessary pressure on you?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, like, self-awareness is so important. You've got to figure out as quickly as possible what works for yourself. And sometimes you'll make a mistake and learn that's not what works for you, but you just have to be aware of that. For me, with social media, I really enjoy social media. I think there's a lot of negativity around it, but there's so much positivity if you look in the right places. And also, if you post content yourself, if you post the right type of content, you can only get positive feedback. Like, you know, there's a whole situation with like trolls and, you know, people that comment on people's posts with really horrible things. For me, I haven't received much of that at all on social media, which I guess is quite fortunate. But I find that's probably because I try and put out a lot of positive energy. I'll get a lot of positive comments back, and that's one thing that helps push me forward. So if people put out negative energy, then it's likely they'll get negative energy back. But also, if you think about the people that are writing these horrible things, like, so what is so wrong in their life that is causing them to take whatever problems they have out on someone that they don't even know? Do you know what I mean? From behind the computer, where they would never ever say those type of things in person. Like, no chance. Going back to my podcast again, Andre told me a story of one time he was in Nando's with one of his friends, and I think he was at Liverpool at the time. I can't remember, but I think he was at Liverpool, and he was on Twitter and saw someone post, "Just been in Nando's, seen Andre Wisdom, he's such a rubbish player, I should go and punch him in the face," right? And then his friend looked at the like profile picture and saw the same guy like sat just over there. So Andre was like, "You know, I'm not having this. Like, there's no reason for anything like that. He's in there paying the same money as everyone else for the food. He just plays football," right? So he gets up and goes over to this guy and says, "Yo, did you post this? Like, what are you saying?" And then the guy was like, "Oh no, mate, it was just banter, blah blah blah." That's literally case in point right there. Exactly. There's no chance that, I mean, maybe 1% of those people will say it to your face if they're drunk or something like that, but most people would never ever say it to your face, so there's no point taking any kind of offense from it.
That's what social media anonymity gives you.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's people with, you know, 10, 15, 20 accounts. Like, it's so wrong. And everything that's happening in football now with the whole racism thing, it's all coming from accounts that aren't necessarily connected to real people. Well, I mean, obviously they're connected to real people, but it's not their like main account.
Exactly. Most of the time, the profile picture's an egg or whatever. Yeah.
So, for one, like, you can't take too much offense from that, because those people are clearly having issues with themselves. So you kind of got to feel sorry for them in certain ways. And number two, like, you'll get what you give. So if you give positive energy and only positive energy, you'll get positive energy back. Like, again, the footballing example, look at Raheem Sterling now. Like, the amount of positive energy that he's putting out is unbelievable, and he's been doing that for a while. He got a little bit of negativity, but he stuck with his positive energy, and it's finally flipped for him. And everything that he's getting right now, he's earned it, because he had so much rubbish that was put his way. So even if you do get negative energy, there's no need to like drop down to their levels.
You're listening to Sportspiel, the Players Podcast. I know there's a lot of talk at the moment about what social media companies can do to limit that, particularly the racism side of things as well, because we're seeing far too much of that in the last few weeks. And I don't know if that's something you have any thoughts on, because I imagine that you'll connect to it a lot better than like I will, for example.
I mean, it's such a difficult one. It's a difficult one for the social media companies, because how do they you know,
keep track of so many accounts as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you can't say, you know, every person can only have one account. You can't say that, because there's so many people that have, you know, personal accounts, then business accounts, and multiple business accounts that, you know, are genuine and for a reason. So you can't say that particular. How do you realistically limit it? That's a conversation that they've got to have, and it's not going to be straightforward for them. It'll probably take a little time to get it right, but when they do, it could be a great thing. The racism thing in football, I think it is. It's just got out. I think the football kind of religion that it is, it's just got out of hand.
People are so tribal now as well.
People are very passionate about the teams that they support, and it's not just the racist comments. It's everything that is said. Like, some of the chants are just horrendous. All the swearing. It's just unnecessary, because at the end of the day, it's a game, right? And the people that are in the stand, there's a reason why you're in the stand and not on the pitch, because you're not good enough. So how can you shout and curse and, you know, disrespect a player that's on the pitch that is clearly good enough and is trying his best to influence a game? How can you shout and tell them what they're doing wrong when you can't actually do it yourself? It's so wrong.
And then I hear, say, former players like John Barnes, for example, saying it's a societal problem, not just a social media problem. I don't know if that's something you would go along with, or if it's something you've seen yourself.
I completely agree with that, because what social media is just doing is exposing everyone. The thoughts were always there.
Just now, so it's got a platform to be
now,
put out there.
Now people have a platform to actually share those thoughts. So the problem with social media isn't because of people having access to share these problems. It's the problem with society in the first place, because the problem's always been there. It's been there for years. It'll probably still be there for a long time, because it's such a difficult thing to change. So in certain ways, you kind of just got to accept it and try and make the best out of the bad situation. But what social media has done is just exposed the problem.
But then if you put the positive energy out, like you were mentioning before,
yeah,
then it's essentially a two-fingered salute to a lot of people.
And also, you know, there's, as I said before, there's so many people on this planet. There's 8 billion people, almost, whatever. You can't control everyone. You can't control everyone. You got good people, you got bad people, you got people in the middle. You can't control everyone. You just got to try and control each situation as best as possible.
Exactly. And I suppose kind of linked to this, and putting out that positive messages, or those positive messages, and being in the place that you are now, i.e. this history-making diver who's, you know, breaking all sorts of records for Jamaica, and does that essentially put you in a position as a role model for a lot of young kids, whether they're from Jamaica or maybe even from Leeds elsewhere in this country, or divers who didn't think they were going to make it, and then here you are, proving a lot of people wrong, essentially. Does the role as a role model, does that take on extra responsibility for you, and is it something you really take passionately and strongly for yourself?
In terms of extra responsibility, I'd not say that, because it's so natural for me. I think I was brought up very, very well by my parents. As difficult as, like, my childhood was in certain ways, my mum and dad did an awesome job of bringing me up in the right way. As I said before, they wanted just to guide me down the right path, and they completely did that, because I think my values and my morals are perfect to be an inspirer and a leader and a role model. So it doesn't take on extra responsibility, because I don't feel like I'm trying hard for it, but it's something that I am passionate about, and that's the reason why I've done the podcast in the way that I have done it, is to inspire young athletes, old athletes, adults, whatever age, people in Jamaica, people in New Zealand, people in, and you know, anywhere in the world, because I think that anyone can take something positive away from what I have to say and the conversation that I have with people. I think anyone can take something positive from that, no matter what they do, whether they are an athlete, whether they are in the world of business and trying to become as successful as possible, whether they are, you know, doing something voluntarily, whatever they're doing, as long as they're trying to be as good as they possibly can be, I think anyone can take something away from that. So I'm quite passionate to try and push it as much as possible, to build almost a legacy for myself, but I feel it's all very natural for me.
And I mean, in terms of sort of difficult childhood, do you mind me asking sort of what we're talking about, or And I suppose if there's any other kids then in a similar situation now, that means you can connect with them a lot better.
It's, yeah, I say difficult with a pinch of salt, because it's, I think it's something that Dave Chappelle said, the comedian. He said it's easy, what did he say? It's easy growing up rich in the poor world, but it's difficult growing up poor in a rich world. Something like that. Mm-hmm. So, for example, where I grew up in Chapeltown, it wasn't the most, you know, well-off place. It was a place with a bad reputation because there was a lot of criminal activity that went on around there. And that's where I grew up. So if you grow up in that kind of place, but you're like kind of, you know, doing all right, which I probably would have been doing in that area, it's easy. But my parents sent me to Leeds Grammar School, which was private school from year three onwards. That was because it was recommended to me by my original school, Allworthy Primary, because I was doing so well in years one and two. They were like, this kid needs a little bit more. So they recommended me to go to private school. At private school, there's a lot of wealthy kids. You know, they have a lot of parents.
Privately educated as well. Yeah. So
There's a lot of kids in my situation that are just, you know, I guess bright. But there's a lot, I don't want to sound like I'm blowing my own trumpet, but there's a lot of kids that have very successful parents and have a lot, they show a lot of wealth because of what their parents, I guess, give to them. I wasn't from the same background. Like, my dad has his own company, and it did, you know, pretty well for a time. It's pretty local. He went bankrupt, I can't remember what year it was, and that was pretty difficult because, you know, they were paying a lot of money for my school, but they didn't have a lot of money coming in. And my mum just works as part of Education Leeds, so she wasn't earning in particular a lot of money. So I was poor in a rich world because I didn't have as much money, or I didn't have as many things. I didn't have, you know, the same freedom as some of my friends had. So I felt like I was so far behind when I was actually in a decent spot in life in general.
But then, because of who you're comparing yourself to, of the company that you're in, it's just only natural when you're that age, isn't
exactly
it?
That's why I say it was difficult with a pinch of salt, just because of the situation that I was in. But the best thing for me is I had diving, I had a sport, I had something that I was passionate about, something that I cared about. And I guess that it was just fortunate that all the cards fell in the right place at the right time, that I found diving and that I was good at it and everything. But I encourage kids to try everything until they find something that they enjoy. Because once they find something that they enjoy, it'll make life easy.
Exactly. For sure. I see that tons of times.
Yeah.
People from various backgrounds, if they have something they're passionate about, mm-hmm. it can take them all sorts of places.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes along with what you said in your most recent podcast episode, actually, and one of your weekly episodes, where your mantra this year, if it's fair to say that, is reap what you sow.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's kind of, Is that a message maybe you've taken throughout your life up to this point, and maybe it's something you just really want to promote this time around?
That's something that I've just heard. I can't remember who said it. I remember who said it. It was Cam Newton. So I'm a big NFL fan. Carolina Panthers is my NFL team. I'm actually going to the London game, which is like in a couple of weeks' time. Carolina are playing. And I was watching the Amazon Prime documentary where they followed the Panthers around, All or Nothing. And I just heard him say that in one of the episodes, you reap what you sow. And that just stuck with me at that particular time. I was like, yeah, you know what? That sounds good. I'm going to smash this preseason as hard as possible, sow the seeds, and hopefully that allow me to flourish. And, you know, if it doesn't, then didn't work hard enough. If it does, then, you know, it was down to that work. And it was worth all the pain. So that's kind of just what I'm saying to myself day by day. Even on the days that I feel like I wake up and I feel a bit rubbish and I don't fancy training, just to remember that everything that I do now has an effect next year. Like, if I go easy one day now, it can have an effect next year, and I don't want that to happen. So I think that's something that I don't think everyone has to particularly live by that. If you're ambitious and you're dreaming of something big in the long-term future, then that's definitely something you should live by, because everything that you do now will have an effect in the future. And I think that can be said of kids and also of parents, because everything that they do now for their kids will have an effect for their kid in the future. So if you, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example, but if you do something that doesn't help your child now, then it's not going to help your child in the future.
Exactly.
And it's hard for me to say that because I don't have a kid.
But it'll have its ramifications later down the line.
It's just from what I've learned as I grew up through from my parents.
One last point as well from that episode is that chocolate cake is your biggest weakness.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of us could probably say the same thing.
Yeah.
So as long as we keep the chocolate cake to a minimum, then we should be fine.
Yeah, to an absolute minimum. That I lost control at the weekend. And that's fine. Like, as I said, you reap what you sow. You've got to put in the work, but it's okay to let loose a couple of times. Like, I've spoken to you very briefly about Gary Vaynerchuk, the businessman that I listen to, his podcast. Very, very good podcast if you want to listen to it. He talks about how from the age of 20 to like 34, he worked in his dad's liquor store and literally did nothing social, just worked hard every single day, like 6 days a week, and did absolutely nothing socially. And it's got him into the position that he's in now, very, very successful position. But in hindsight, he looks back and say, you know what? It wouldn't have hurt if I had taken a weekend or a couple of days here and there to actually enjoy myself. It wouldn't have hurt. Right. Obviously for him that was his natural state, like he wanted to just work hard, but as I say, it's okay to relax every once in a while, but as long as you do everything that you need to do at the right time, you can't complain.
Exactly. And as the tannoy quickly talks over me, we've had that before. My final question, to sort of bring our chat to an end, sort of a big one, firstly, when are you next competing? But finally, why should people take an interest in diving if that's something they want to take an interest into?
My next competition will probably be Scottish Nationals at the end of this year. That'll probably be my first competition of the season. Don't expect it to go too well, just getting back into the swing of things. My next majors happen in 2020, so I've got a few Grand Prix and then the World Cup, which is my last qualifying opportunity for the Olympics. So that's where all my focus is geared towards at the moment. The reason why I laughed is when you asked why people should take up diving, and I can kind of give a not so good answer in terms of diving is a horrible, horrible sport. When you wipe out, it hurts. It's completely against all human nature. Heights, being upside down, spinning in the air, being underwater, completely against human nature. So it's not an easy sport to take up. And also it's one of those sports where essentially requires perfection, which most other sports don't require. Like in football, you can make a mistake and your teammates will back you up. In diving, if you make a mistake, then you're pretty much out of the running. You don't have much chance of achieving what you want to achieve, and that is really tough to deal with. So for those reasons, I say completely avoid diving by all means possible. But for me, diving has given me opportunities that I would have never ever seen coming from where I came from. It's allowed me to travel the world, which, you know, there's no reason why I ever would have gone to China or to Russia or to Peru. Probably there's absolutely no reason why I would have ever done that, but as little as I've actually been able to see in those destinations, you know, it's been amazing to see different cultures, understand the world for what it is, appreciate how different people live, and try and take those values and, you know, use those to better myself. That's one of the best things that I've taken from that. I've made so many friends from around the world. Like, I'll confidently say that two of my best friends in diving are both from New Zealand, which makes no sense, because how can you have best friends from New Zealand? And actually now we're all based in different continents. Like, I'm in Europe, one of them is in Oceania in New Zealand, and the other one's in America, so we only get to see each other like twice a year at competitions. But every single time that we meet up now, we always make sure to spend some time together, and it creates stories and creates memories from all the competitions that we do. And also, like, most places that I go in the world, I have somewhere to stay or I have a friend. Like, one of the friends that I made in the diving world is from Miami. Like, he's literally like, every time I come to Miami, just tell him and I can stay at his house for free. makes life a lot easier.
It does.
And that's something that I've been able to get through diving, is those connections around the world, which, as I say, people from where I'm from, that doesn't happen to, and most people in general, like, you don't get those kind of connections, and that's something that diving has given me. And it's such an exciting sport. Every single day is different, even the frustrating days. It's a challenge, but it makes it worth it when it eventually goes right, and you have some great days where you can't do a thing wrong, and it's just the best feeling. And I mean, I can't speak for many other sports, but obviously scoring a goal in football is a great feeling, or sticking a landing in gymnastics is a good feeling, or, you know, breaking your PB is a good feeling. But when you've done a perfect dive and you go through the water and you can feel the tear through the water, and you come out, especially when it's in competition, you can hear the crowd cheering, there's absolutely no better feeling than that. I've not experienced a better feeling in life apart from that moment. And it's just one of the most rewarding things, because you know you've done every single step correctly. There's been no accidents. You didn't get lucky. Every single step that you've done has been correct to get to that moment. And it's the small things that really like have a big effect. So those are the reasons why I'd say get involved in diving. And it might not happen to everyone, but the diving community is so friendly, unlike the swimming community, for example, where it's a little bit more intense, a little bit more rivalries. The diving community is so friendly, like, everyone wants to support each other, everyone wants to see everyone do as well as possible, because at the end of the day, you're on your own. You don't influence anyone else when you're on the board. You can only rely on yourself. So, you know, if someone dives better than you, they're just better diving than you. There's not much you could have done more yourself, rather than, you know, training harder beforehand. So they're probably the three best things about diving for me. And I'd encourage anyone to get into it because of those reasons. But regardless, like, if you find a sport, I encourage you to do sport to the best standard you possibly can, because I think that sport gives you so many experiences and so many valuable opportunities that are just inaccessible in other walks of life. I think from like, even like university, the general working life, unless you're at a very high level, you don't get any of the same experiences that you can get much easier in sport. So regardless of what sport is you're interested in, I'd encourage you to just try everything. Find the thing that you're best at and just do it to the best of your ability, because for one, you'll stay fit, which is very important. Two, you'll learn discipline. And three, you'll get so many valuable life experiences that will help set you up for later life.
That perfectly sums up, I suppose, our overriding message that we've always had on the show about how important sport can be.
Yeah.
Away from the pure results 100%. Side of things. There's the fitness side, there's the social side, and then there's the life lessons side of things as well.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to guess that quite a few people have learned some of their own life lessons listening to this conversation.
Yep.
So with that, I'll round off this episode. And thank you once again, Yona, for coming on. Again, I'll say thank you because I know it's been a long trip to get down here. But no, thank you so much for coming on to the show. I think I speak for a lot of listeners and saying this is the kind of thing we love doing. Just finding out all about our guests and what actually makes them the people that they are. And some very important messages there, I think, as well, whether it's from the sporting side of things, the diving side of things, the social media side of things as well, but also giving yourself that motivation and that time as well to yourself to improve things and all that sort of stuff.
100%.
And everyone subscribe to your podcast, The Athlete's Voice, as well. We'll
yes,
put
please.
A nice little plug in there as
yes,
well.
Please.
I mean, even the weekly episodes, I think there's a lot of valuable things to be taken away from those.
Absolutely.
As well.
And it's great to have the opportunity to like share my story in a different way to how I normally would on my own episodes, because the way I talked on this was so much different to how I talk on my own ones, so it was actually quite interesting to hear the words come out of my mouth more than anything. But my podcast goes in a completely different way, but I appreciate you getting me on and being interested in my journey as well.
Right, plenty to be interested in, so we look forward to next competition as well and see
thank
how the
much.
Next few months go.
Absolutely.
A big thank you to Yona for taking the time to speak with us on this episode of the show. As ever, there were plenty of topics to go through, and you can find a link to the athlete's voice in the show notes. You can also find a written accompanying feature on our website. Shares and some ratings on Apple Podcasts would be amazing, as it helps people to find us. We will be back next weekend with our monthly roundtable discussion episode, so make sure you keep an eye on the social media platforms for updates. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and all of our handles are SportsBuildPod. With that, make sure you spread the word, listeners, and we will see you very soon.